Welcome to Talking Books on Campus FM. I'm Patricia Camilleri, and in this series I discuss books and what they mean to my guests on the programme. I feel most privileged to have with me today Dr. Carol Cunihan, who is in Malta to participate in a series of lectures organised by the Department of Tourism within the Faculty of Economics, Management and Accountancy here at the University. Dr. Cunihan will be giving some lectures to the Diploma in Gastronomy students and also a public lecture during her stay. And she has kindly also agreed to be interviewed on Campus FM. Just a quick word about my guest. She is a Professor of Anthropology at Millersville University, which is one of the 14 universities in the Pennsylvania State System of Higher Education. She has a BA in History from Stanford University, cum laude, and a PhD in Anthropology from the University of Massachusetts at Amherst. She has been active in anthropology, gender and food studies for over two decades and has conducted ethnographic research in Sardinia and Florence as well as in the US. Dr. Cunihan is the author of a number of fascinating publications. Three of these are Around the Tuscan Table, Food, Family and Gender in 20th Century Florence, published in 2004, The Anthropology of Food and Body, Gender, Meaning and Power in 1999, and her latest book, A Tortilla is Like Life. And I look forward to hearing more about these and her other works. Welcome, Dr. Cunihan.
Thank you.
Well, I looked at your CV and I noticed that you've moved from history to anthropology to the study of food. What was the reason for that iter? What drew you really to study the significance of food?
I would say I can blame it all on Italy. As a history major as an undergraduate, it really didn't speak to my soul. And so when I graduated from college, I returned to Italy where I had been a study abroad student as an undergraduate. I went back to Florence and just was living life and enjoying the culture for, I'd say a couple of years. And then I said, I need to do something with my life. I had a boyfriend, as most people do when they come to Italy, and we traveled a lot, and we ended up traveling to Sardinia. And I remember being so struck by the difference that I saw in Sardinia. It was still quite traditional. The pastoral economy was still very alive, and people were riding donkeys and going after the sheep, and that struck me. But even more than the traditional lifestyle was the incredible warmth and generosity of the Sardinians, and which often expressed itself through the offering of food. So as soon as you came into a town, you would be welcomed into a cafe, and people would be buying you drinks or food or whatever. People invited you into their home for a meal, and this really struck me. So after a couple of trips to Sardinia, as I was thinking about my life, I said, I know, I want to be an anthropologist and study Sardinia. So I went back then to the United States to start graduate school. And as I sort of progressed in my studies, I had to start thinking about a focus for my dissertation. At that point, again, I was kind of sitting at the table one day thinking, what am I going to study? I know, I'll study food. Since Italians talk about food all the time anyway, whether you ask them about it or not, I thought, I will study food, and I had been in Florence most of those 3 years I spent in Italy after college, and in Tuscany, of course, there's an amazingly rich food culture. So it was sort of partly coming out of my experience in Tuscany and partly from these visits to Sardinia. And so my dissertation was actually on, it was called Food, Culture, and Political Economy, Changing Lifestyles in the Sardinian Town of Boza. So that's where I went to do my doctoral research.
I can't imagine anything nicer.
Yes, it was really, really interesting.
We've become accustomed to the idea of novels that revolve around food. The obvious examples that spring to mind are Chocolat and Like Water for Chocolate. They discuss this great power of food. Is this a phenomenon, this awareness of the power of food, is this a phenomenon of now? Have we just discovered it? Or have we known that food can express significance? Have we known that for a long time?
I guess it sort of depends who the we is, because I think for scholars, the focus on food has been pretty recent. I started my dissertation work in the late 70s, 78, 79, and at that time I felt like I could read everything that had been written in the social sciences on food. Probably didn't read everything, but I felt like, okay, I can command the field, because not much scholarship had been done on it. Anthropologists had always written about food because in the societies that we study, the kind of pre-capitalist, pre-literate societies, food was always the center of the economy, of social life, ideology, and so forth. So anthropologists had written about it kind of in passing, but it was really, I would say, until maybe the past 10, 20 years that scholars began to pay serious attention. Now, that said, if you look across cultures, in all times and all places, food has had a really central role, not just in the economy, in women's work, in the, you know, home, whatever the home was, but in religion, religious rituals, giving foods to the gods, giving food to the dead, these kinds of things. So I think people have always known that food is important, but scholars, I think, kind of took it for granted. And I think that was probably in part due to the fact that it was so much the realm of women, and scholars didn't pay particular attention to what women were doing.
In fact, we have a couple of our own homegrown scholars here who study the food that was eaten during the nights period. They dig up these recipes that we find, or descriptions of banquets and this sort of thing, mm-hmm. And also in the medieval period prior to the arrival of the knights. And I can remember when they started doing their studies and coming up with papers which involved food, and there was a sort of a sense of consternation almost from people, other scholars at the time, as though it were somehow, well, an interesting sideline, but, you know, it wasn't really serious.
Yes.
I suspect that that has definitely changed, as you say, in the last, say, 10 years, something like that.
Yeah, I mean, there's an incredible fluorescence of studies now in all across, from, you know, history, sociology, anthropology, literature, philosophy, film studies, even architecture. You hear people sort of thinking about the ways in which food intersects and cuts across so much of our life.
You obviously mentioned Italy as being the thing that, the place that made you interested in food, and certainly it is a fascinating place, especially from that regional point of view that you were mentioning, that when you went to Sardinia, you sort of saw it different from Tuscany or other places that you'd been. And it always makes me think when, I don't know, they have a television quiz program, for example, and one of the questions will be, you know, where does this wine come from? And they'll give them four choices of area. And usually they get them right, because Italians are fairly well versed in this sort of area. And the fact that you can talk about a particular cheese that comes from that particular town or village sometimes, definitely, of course, that particular wine that comes from that particular region, there is such diversity in Italy that maybe in obviously in somewhere like France that would be so, but that makes Italian study is so interesting, and then looking at it as you are doing from the anthropological point of view, it must be amazing. What was the speciality in the village that you were studying in Sardinia?
In Bolza, one of the prime products was Malvasia di Bolza, which is a white wine that is made, I think one of the places that it's made is in San Gimignano in Tuscany, but the Malvasia di Bolza is, of course, different. And it is a white wine that's very, very strong alcohol content. Probably, I'm not a wine expert, but probably due to the fact that they prune the vines to be very small with very few grappoli, you know, very few clusters. And there's so much sun that you get very intense sugar concentration, which then when you ferment it makes this delicious, very potent wine. So that was one of the prime products.
And at the time that you were there, was there still this rather almost feudal approach to farming? What was the social setup vis-a-vis the farmers themselves?
The sort of past tradition had been, as you say, quite feudal, large landowners with peasant workers, which was somewhat unusual for Sardinia because Bolza was a town of about 9,000 with a history of class stratification in the town. Most of the Sardinian towns were far less stratified, smaller, that, you know, around 3,000, and there were more small landowners, whereas in Bolza there were fewer small landowners and more kind of proletarian peasants. When I was there, however, agriculture was not doing well. And as one person said to me, l'agricoltura è a terra, agriculture is in the dirt, which I thought was pretty funny pun, but which was his way of saying, you know, we can't make a living working the land anymore because the cost of labor had gone up so much relative to what they could glean from their work on the land.
But certainly in Italy, there is this idea of specialization, that what the Italians do well is that top quality product.
Right.
So I think perhaps in recent years, mm-hmm. There has been a new awareness of the value of these products. The very fact that, I don't know, the Parmigiano has now got the etichetta that, you know, only they can call it Parmigiano,
right.
And these other things. So I would imagine that would have an effect on the economy of the area.
Yes, and I mean, it's been over 20 years since I've been to Bolza, so I'm sure that things have changed. And what they've managed to do in Tuscany and in Emilia-Romagna with Prosciutto di Parma and Parmigiano is make a very high-quality product and then develop a marketing strategy so that the product is remunerated. In what I saw in Bolza was they didn't have the sort of marketing structure and the public relations ability to project into a broader market their quality products. So I think it's a really good question, are they able to do that today? And that's part of the work that Slow Food is doing, which is my most recent research. I'm looking at slow food chapters in Italy, in local areas on the ground, to see what those chapters and the volunteers who work with them are doing to promote local products. And I hope to go back to Sardinia soon and look really much more closely at what they're doing on the ground with their own products and producers.
So, in fact, now there is this Slow Food Association. This is sort of spreading all over all over Italy.
Yes.
And even here in Malta, I can think of a restaurant that does promote itself as a slow food center.
Mm-hmm.
I presume to counteract as well the idea of the fast food, which many Italians find a sort of anathema, really, to their to their way of life and their idea of sitting down and eating anything quickly is really not on the cards, is it?
Right. Yeah, I think it was in 1986 the first McDonald's opened in Rome on the Spanish Steps, and it was in response to that that a group of political activists said, we're gonna start Slow Food. It had a different name in the beginning, but the goals of Slow Food are good, clean, and fair food. So tasty, nutritious, delicious, local, produced sustainably without a lot of chemicals, and under fair conditions for the people that do the work, and fair prices for the consumers. That's kind of in a nutshell Slow Food's goal. And now they are, I think there are 100,000 members in 120 or 30 countries. So I know that here in Malta you've got a Slow Food Convivium or chapter that's fairly recently open.
I was going to say that the Anglo-Saxons don't seem to get it about food in the same way that the Mediterranean peoples do. I can just about say that without offending anybody, being British myself. Do you think that's true? Obviously, it's a generalization, because I mean there's wonderful food to be having in Britain. And I know that lately they've been concentrating on developing local cheeses, and there's been quite a lot of advertising. I've noticed on the BBC television they give quite a lot of space to this sort of thing. Do you think that there is a cultural difference between, a social cultural difference between the Northern Europeans and the Mediterranean that makes this so? Is there a connection?
Oh boy, that's a tough question. I mean, I think certainly to the casual observer, there definitely seems to be some differences, particularly in Italy, the country that I know the best. To what extent it's due to culture, to what extent it's due to environment, this is something I'm really playing around with. My most recent book, Tortillas Like Life, was based on research in the San Luis Valley of Colorado, which is on the northern extreme of the Mexican and Spanish influence in the United States. So just north of New Mexico, in an area that was once part of Mexico until 1848. Why I bring this up is this is a very high-altitude community. It's almost 8,000 feet or 2,400 meters, and there are only two frost-free months a year. So you have a very short growing season, and as a result, a fairly monotonous diet based on beans, potatoes, meat, and then whatever fruits and vegetables you can grow in a very short growing season. And what in the old days they would do was dry the foods for the winter, dry them and put them in root cellars. So you maybe had collected vast quantities of quelites, or what they call wild spinach, in the spring and summer, and then dry them for the winter. Well, what struck me is this is not a particularly exciting and tasty diet, and hence I'm wondering if this is the reason why food seems to be less central to the culture. I mean, it certainly still plays a very important role, but in Tuscany, where you have something fresh coming in all year round, and it's like, oh, now it's the time of artichokes, yay, let's eat artichokes. And then it's asparagus, and then it's tomatoes. And, you know, you sort of have this bounty of fresh, delicious food grown locally, eaten close to home, which is makes it all the more tasty. So I don't know if this could be applied to Northern Europe as well, where you don't have as long a growing season, you don't have as much variety in the products that you're eating, and thus maybe you're taking food more sort of as fuel rather than as life force and soul of a culture.
In England now, I think the most popular meal is chicken tikka masala or something similar.
Yeah.
And that probably reflects the urbanization of society as well.
Mm-hmm.
It's not just, it doesn't just reflect the demographics or the people that there are now in Britain. It also reflects the fact that people perhaps don't have time to cook, I imagine. I don't know what you feel about that. Whether
mm-hmm.
And these meals are very often taken off the supermarket shelf rather than cooked.
Mm-hmm. Sure. I think that the speeding up of society, the busyness, is playing a very important role on the cuisine because fewer and fewer people have time to cook. I had one of my students last semester do a paper on college students' definitions of cooking. And their definitions are rather strange to those of us who grew up, you know, at the stove. Is sort of any application of heat. So microwaving a pizza is cooking. But what she found, more importantly than their definition of cooking, was the fact that they simply don't have time to cook. In the U.S., a lot of the students at my university are holding part-time jobs, taking a full course load, running around in their cars from one thing to another, and so cooking has just disappeared. Similarly, with the increasing entrance of women into the workforce in many cultures, the women were the ones who traditionally did the cooking and shopping and cleanup in the home. With a reduction in time, something has to give, and so this, I think, is why more families rely on takeout or processed food.
In fact, you've done a lot of study, I noticed, obviously, from your books, about gender barriers and what in the food situation. The new man. Okay, we've said that people don't have time to cook as much as they did before, but perhaps with the idea of a more sharing environment, the new man being somebody who actually might even cook supper,
mm-hmm.
If his wife isn't available to do it, or they might simply by choice share that. This rather also changes the structure of the family as such.
Mm-hmm.
Do you see that as an influence on our family life?
Sure, absolutely, because the preparing and giving of food is such an important sign and practice of nurture. And so in a family where this was all done by a woman, the man was kind of outside that ability to intimately nurture the children. With men being involved in cooking, I think they have a bigger role to play in the emotional connection with the children. I know my husband likes to cook, and he also sort of took on early on the making of the birthday cakes for our sons. So in some sense, of course, that's festive cooking, that's special cooking, but it is a way of expressing connection. What's interesting is, are the men entering into all of the domestic chores equally, or are they selectively entering and choosing cooking? And I know in my book on Florence, Around the Tuscan Table, I had one woman whose husband loved to cook. He was retired. She was still working. She was a factory worker. And he did the shopping and cooking. But he said to me, you know, Carol, here's the thing. When I'm done, I leave a mountain of dishes. And his wife said, look, I am glad to have the help, but believe me, he doesn't do anything else. And what I really want is someone to do the ironing. So it was almost like men had the privilege of choosing. And when you can choose, cooking may be the thing you pick because it's so creative, it's so fulfilling, it's satisfying, especially if it's a choice and not just simply assigned to you.
And also, I mean, the great chefs have been men.
Yes.
Until now. I know there are many more top chefs who are female.
Right.
But so in the back of their minds, most men do know that it's okay for men to cook, really.
Yes, yes, indeed.
One quick question, which I'm dying to ask, because I feel you might be able to answer it for me. What makes a food culturally acceptable in one country and yet 50 miles away totally unacceptable? I mean, the obvious example is frog's legs in Calais, which in Dover definitely would not be found on the menu.
Yeah.
How does this happen?
Well, I guess I could sort of go back to Claude Lévi-Strauss, who said foods are not only good to eat, but they're good to think. And so there are many edible substances that people do not define as food because they are mentally or ideologically unacceptable. And I think the way in which groups use food is very often to establish identity and boundaries. So, you know, the sort of classic example is Jewish dietary law with a series of prohibitions, for example, on pork. The following of a set of culinary rules that define some things like beef as edible, when prepared, of course, slaughtered and prepared properly, and other things like pork as inedible, is a way to say we are different. We are a community that is different from that community over there. And this is, I think, extremely important worldwide. And, you know, what happens to it today with the globalization of foodways is another question.
Interesting. Well, thank you very, very much, Dr. Carol Cunningham, for coming to talk to us about food and society today.
Thank you for listening to Talking Books. I hope you can join us next week. This is Patricia Camilleri saying goodbye.